WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In her new book, The Mommy Myth, The Idealization of Motherhood and How It Has Undermined Women, Susan Douglas describes the Eau de Mama as an exotic perfume that gets released in the bodies and minds of mothers. You know the one that allows a highly successful woman, after a long day at work, to coo with delight at changing her baby's diapers when she gets home. Of course, before she prepares a gourmet meal and gathers up mounds of toys from the floor. It portrays a mother as sexy as a Victoria's Secret model and as attentive to domestic details as Martha Stewart, even when she is soothing a screaming baby at 4:30 in the morning. Actresses on the covers of Vogue and In Style are flush with Eau de Mama. But, says Susan Douglas, she and most other mothers are not. And just because they'd rather read a novel once in a while than play endless games of Barbie, they do not have attitude problems. Tonight on Point, the media and the unrealistic standard they have set for women. Do you agree with Catherine Zeta-Jones that motherhood is sexy? Do these images of perfect mothers make you feel like you don't measure up? Do they make you mad? What's motherhood like for you? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is Susan Douglas, professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan, co-author of the new book, The Mommy Myth, and also the author of Listening In, Radio and the American Imagination, and Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Gail. Great to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us, and it's certainly a provocative idea. You say there's a new momism afoot, and it sounds like it's what we experienced in the 50s.
It's actually worse than the 50s, I have to say. You know, the new momism refers to this completely romanticized, utterly demanding myth of the perfect mother, in which the standards for success are pretty much impossible to achieve. And if we think about June Cleaver, you know, harkening back to the 1950s as a sort of exemplar of the, you know, doting 1950s suburban mom, even June Cleaver was not expected to pipe Mozart into her womb so that the beaver came out perfectly tuned, you know. She wasn't expected to drill the beaver with flashcards when he was 6 months old. She wasn't expected to have the beaver read the Iliad by the time he was in kindergarten. You know, the to-do list has gotten endless and the standards are completely over the top.
And so how did that happen? How did the standards get to be so impossibly high?
Well, you know, one of the things we sought to do in the book was kind of go back and do a sort of collective tour down memory lane, you know, to how we got where we are. And, you know, what emerges are several factors. One is fear. The news media discovered endangered children as a very sensational, newsworthy topic in the mid-1980s. And so beginning, you know, in the early to mid-80s, we got, for example, razor blades and Halloween candy, which turned out, of course, to be an urban legend. We had daycare centers allegedly staffed by Satanists and pedophiles. Missing children were everywhere, and the media at that time trafficked in incredibly exaggerated statistics about how many kids were missing. So mothers became terrified about leaving their kids in the front yard to play or, you know, letting them go to daycare centers. So fear was an important element that has only snowballed. Another element has been fantasy. We saw the rise of the dreaded celebrity mom profile, which is so ubiquitous now that it's hard to imagine a time when they didn't exist. But if you go back and look at the covers of women's magazines in the 1970s, there actually were hardly any of them. You know, and that begins to change in the 1980s so that by the late 80s, celebrity mom profiles on the covers of these magazines account for one-fifth to one-quarter of them. So there you are, a harried mom, you know, you're at the checkout counter with, you know, a couple kids screaming, you know, at your legs. And there are all of these celebrity mothers with their perfect hair, perfect makeup, perfect husbands, and you open the magazines and inside they have white furniture and white rugs.
Right.
Right? And they're telling you all of the things they're doing to ensure that their kid is, you know, is going to be a Nobel laureate by the time he or she is 12. But you know what was really pernicious about these as well? They told you how you were supposed to feel. And you were supposed to feel ecstatic and blissful all the time. And real mothers, without a SWAT team of nannies, don't feel blissful and ecstatic all the time.
Well, and even beyond that, I noticed that these articles seldom, if ever, mention, and oh, by the way, this woman has a hairstylist who travels with her and a makeup artist and three nannies and four housekeepers and whatever. I mean, that there's this huge support system that the average woman certainly does not have.
That's right. We don't have the SWAT team of nannies, the personal assistant, the French chateau, and the joyful outlook that goes with that, you know. Now, having said this, you know, mothers do talk back to these kinds of images. There was a cover story about Cindy Crawford a couple of years ago in which she had a first baby, and there were these huge blaring headlines, boy, oh, boy. You know, like, this is, you know, national news, right? Cindy Crawford has a baby. And 2 weeks later, the letters pages in People were filled with letters from irate women who were saying, excuse me, of course she, you know, is back to her, you know, pre-birth weight, and of course she's ecstatic and happy. She has all this help that we don't have. So, you know, mothers do talk back to this kind of imagery. But having said that, I think when you have various media outlets, the news, women's magazines, marketing, which I can talk about in a minute, made for TV movies, on and on, that collectively, and I don't mean this to be conspiratorially, they just, you know, snowball with and against each other, produce this kind of common sense about what the standards are for motherhood, this common sense about the perfect mother that gets misted into the air. You can talk back to it and say, you know, I don't buy into this. But you can also believe that it's a standard against which you will be measured. And so even though you think I can resist it, you also suspect that other people will judge you by it. And that's how it becomes, you know, so, you know, onerous and judgmental.
There is a picture you have in one section of the book, which I have to say I just laughed out loud because it shows this lovely young woman, presumably a mother, in a haute couture gown, and she has a naked toddler on one hip. And, you know, you have to look at that and think, that stylist must have been cringing, you know, as that picture was made, because I don't know that I'd put my money on the toddler in that one. But does that sort of message make a, I mean, you have to look at that and laugh, but is there this little insidious thing that makes us feel that, you know, we should be living that life?
Well, you know, what you're talking about is the baby as accessory, right? The baby is something that makes you look good in an evening gown or a rocking chair. And of course, in real life, you know, the baby might be screaming, you know, in the rocking chair or throwing up on the evening gown. So, you know, you're very right that these kind of idealized images of babies as, you know, accessories that make us look maternal and worthwhile and, you know, very feminine, quote unquote. In real life, they're little people that need you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that's a very demanding job. And I just want to emphasize here, do we love our kids? Of course we love our kids. We all love our kids. You know, that's a separate issue from whether tending to them is or should be thought of as eternally blissful. And I do think that young women in this country have been sold a bill of goods about how blissful it is and how wonderful it is. And when I've been around the country on tour for this book, what I've found young women saying to me is that they have felt kind of censored, like they can't admit that it's hard work. They can't admit that sometimes it drives them nuts. They can't admit that they're exhausted. They can't admit that sometimes they're ambivalent. Well, why not? You know, that's part of motherhood.
And why is that the code of silence? It's an interesting point. And also, it's not just that you have to have a big successful career and then you have to be the perfect domestic diva when you're at home and all of that. There's another piece now that you point out, which is in addition to everything else, as you alluded to a moment ago, you're supposed to be a therapist.
You are supposed to be everything. My God, you're supposed to be Dr. Mom, right? A pediatrician. You're supposed to be an arts and crafts specialist, you know, making all these, you know, turning your napkins into flamingos or whatever. You're supposed to be a homeschooler, whether you're homeschooling or not. You're supposed to be devoting all your time to making sure that your kids know Latin or the geography of the United Arab Emirates or whatever. You're supposed to be a therapist. You're supposed to be a child development expert. You're supposed to be a consumer product safety inspector so that, you know, the camp that your kids go to in the summer, you've already checked out. I mean, when does it stop?
And you've sewn in all the name tags, of course, into those little camp clothes.
Color-coded.
But one of the things, too, that has to be factored in is that, indeed, many mothers of small children really do feel that tug, really do want to be with them, and that should be okay, too.
Well, I want to say a couple of things about that. One, of course, you know, we're totally tied to our kids, you know, and I wrote the book as somebody very tied, you know, to my daughter. But my point is that that's where they get us. That's where marketers get us. That's where the news media get us. That's where made-for-TV movies get us. They get us at that very point of our love for our kids. And then they take that tie to our kids and that love for our kids and exploit it and turn it around into a set of standards that are impossible to achieve. And the other thing I would say is that the book really takes issue with the notion of the mommy wars, you know, that stay-at-home mothers and working mothers are supposed to be at odds with each other. I think this is a real red herring. Are there sometimes tensions between working mothers and stay-at-home mothers? Sure there are. But has this been magnified and exaggerated all out of proportion to what really goes on, you know, down on the ground with mothers? You bet. I mean, it helps sell magazines and TV shows. I mean, Dr. Phil recently had some show where, you know, he put the stay-at-home mothers on one side and the working mothers on the other side, and I presume there was supposed to be, you know, like maternal mud wrestling, you know. But in real life, as a working mother, I know lots of stay-at-home mothers. Guess what we do? We bail each other out all the time. We schlep each other's kids around. We look out for each other's kids. We cooperate. You know, we don't hate each other. You know, so I think this war is highly magnified. And the, you know, and there's no, why should there be one size fits all about motherhood? Some of us like to stay home with our kids. Some of us want to work. Some of us need to work. You know, it's these wars in which we're supposed to be opposed to each other, I think, are incredibly artificial, but they help sell media products.
Well, I was going to say, so do you think this is primarily about economics because we're a big market, or is it about politics or that plus, 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 plus?
Well, I think that plus, plus, but I, you know, I think there has been a powerful interaction between politics and economics. I mean, one of the things that we haven't talked about is how marketing and advertising have changed powerfully since the 1980s. There's been the explosive rise in what we call niche marketing, right? And this has corresponded to the rise in cable television and the proliferation of magazines and all the rest. And so kids have been divided up into niche markets so that now, you know, I mean, you and I have teenagers, so we were just at the beginning of this niche marketing stuff. Now, young mothers today, kids are divided up into 0 to 3 months, 3 months to 6 months, and so on and so forth. And each of them is accompanied by a bleacher load of products that if you don't buy, your kid's going to be left in the dust by, you know, by the kids whose savvy smart mothers bought these products. And, you know, as a mother of a 15-year-old, I cannot believe the range of products that are in the market for mothers today that weren't there, you know, just 14, 13 years ago.
And again, playing into the fears and the guilt and the interests of mothers at varying stages of motherhood.
Absolutely. I mean, look, you know, to talk about politics for a minute, we can come back to this, but in a very broad way, you know, our country talks about mothers and motherhood in kind of, you know, glowing rhetoric, but in reality, what have we done politically for mothers? Nothing, you know. What have we done for families? Nothing, you know. Oh, there's all this praise about family values and this and that, but compared to pretty much all the European countries and Japan, our policies are in the Stone Age. And so here you have mothers looking around, and I look around as a mother, and I see even the institutions my mother in the 50s could count on, good public schools, etc., you know, they're gone. So what do mothers feel? They got to pick up the slack.
All right. Hold that thought. We're going to be back to talk much more about images of motherhood in the media and how realistic they are. Should the government do something to help overworked mothers? And what can companies do? Have we gone back to the 1950s ideal of motherhood? And how real was that ideal? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about images of motherhood in the media. Have stories about daycare disasters made you feel guilty about going to work? Do some women actually have it all? A demanding career, a happy family, and a loving husband? Is that you? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Susan Douglas, professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan and co-author of the new book, The Mommy Myth. And let's go to one of our callers. Anu is on the line from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, what's on your mind?
First of all, I just wanted to thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you for having this topic on. I've really enjoyed the discussion so far. It's been really fun to listen to, but also just really wonderfully realistic. The point that was on my mind is I've noticed amongst my professional friends, many of whom are having children now, that unfortunately this pressure to have it all often leads them to make decisions that affect their family life based on how the public is going to view them. Instead of, you know, I think the decision of whether to stay home with your children and how much time to spend working or doing other things, I think is a very personal decision that should really be made within the family. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very dependent on the family's needs and the individuals within the family. But unfortunately, I've seen a lot of women feel pressured to make these decisions based on how the public is going to view them.
Was it hard for you to make that choice?
It wasn't too hard for me to initially make the choice. I was a professional. I decided to stay home with when we had our first child. But it was very hard for me to deal with the backlash. Mm. I had a lot of people telling me, oh, you're going to be miserable. You know, how could you turn your brain off in this way? I had a lot of backlash. So that was hard for me to deal with. And I've been sad to see that a lot of my friends have made the decision to go to work because they felt that they couldn't handle that backlash. And I don't think that should be the reason.
All right. Anu, let's put the question to Susan Douglas. And also, can we deal with this thing about you can have it all? Maybe you can have it all sequentially. Can you have it all at once?
You know, I have to say that I'm not really sure who came up with this, you can have it all, you know. And some people will say, oh, feminists came up with that. Well, I don't think so. You know, feminists were really asking for men to help more with the family and for the government to help more with the family. So the you can have it all thing, I think, comes as much out of advertising as any place else. But, you know, I'm interested in Anu's point because I think that mothers feel pressures both ways, right? I don't think you can win. If you choose to stay at home, you know, there's pressure to, oh, are you letting down your female children? Are you being boring? You know, and stay-at-home mothers will say they go to cocktail parties, and as soon as they say they're staying at home with their kids, people turn their backs. You know, that's a kind of a, you know, a legendary story now. If women go back to work, and many women go back to work, it's not a choice. They go back to work because they have to. They need the money. And then they feel guilt-tripped. And I guess my point is, you know, why are we so hard on ourselves? Why are we so hard on each other? And why do we allow, as Anu rightly pointed out, women's individual choices that rest primarily with the family, why should those be policed so heavily?
Or
questioned by anybody, exactly right. Each of us makes our own choices. But when I say choice, I really want to emphasize this. Many mothers, most mothers, don't have choices. They have kids, and then they've got to deal with the realities of their situation. And for most women who have children, they have to continue working. Having said that, some women who have children are forced not to work because the daycare near them is either so expensive that by the time they go back to work, their entire salary goes for the daycare, or the daycare is of a lousy quality. So mothers' choices are seriously and severely constrained in this country, no matter what their heart tells them to do.
I want to go back for a moment to the point we were making earlier about how unrealistically high the standards have gotten. Because as you point out in the book, it was not always thus. You know, there was a time when it was actually okay to send store-bought cookies to the school bake sale and to have a few dust bunnies, you know, happily growing under your bed. What changed?
Well, you know, what I think would be so therapeutic would be for the mothers of America to go to their library and see if they could exhume, you know, magazines from the 1970s, especially Ms., but not only Ms. I mean, there have been all of these stereotypes that feminists allegedly were anti-kid, anti-homemaker, anti-family. I have to tell you, nothing could be further from the truth. And what was really important to do in the book was to go back to the 70s and kind of dust off this amnesia and misinformation we have about the women's movement. You go back to the pages of Ms. Magazine, and there was constant advocacy for the rights of homemakers, for the fact that housework and caregiving was undervalued. There was tons of stuff about kids and motherhood and the need for high-quality daycare and all of the rest. You know, it was kids and motherhood were at the center of the women's movement, not peripheral. Guess why? Most of the feminists were mothers. You know, the ones who became famous, Kate Millett, Gloria Steinem, were single. Those were the women that the media singled out. But the ones who were doing, like, the hardcore work, they were mothers, and motherhood mattered to them. And so if you look at the even magazines like McCall's or Ladies' Home Journal in the 1970s, completely different story from today. No celebrity moms. Instead, they were trying to be a switchboard among mothers who were really struggling to figure out how to proceed, because in the 1970s, it wasn't only that the women's movement was urging women and giving women permission to enter the workforce. The economy was terrible. Women had to work, and the divorce rate was very high, and women were basically one divorce away from poverty. So there were a whole load of factors propelling women into the workforce, and the women's magazines understood that and tried to deal with that. And I'll have to tell you, you know, in the age of, you know, the Martha Stewartization of America, although we may be post-Martha Stewart, in the 70s, one of the first things the women's magazine said is, let the housework go, right?
Let's bring in one of our callers now from New Bedford, Massachusetts. Mary Beth is on the line. Hi, Mary Beth. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I just kind of wanted to speak to the ideal, I don't know, the transformation that happens when you become a mom. I was saying earlier I had a nanny job for years, and, you know, I found myself young and taking care of these little girls, and, you know, the mom worked, which was why I was there, and, you know, it was interesting. I sort of went home at the end of the day and thought, does she need to work? Does she need to, why can't she stay home? And yet I had this great respect for what she was doing out in the world, and, like, you know, I looked to her very much as a role model. And I realized that, you know, when she came home from work, she was 100% there for her children and happy at work and happy at home. And, you know, I have a one-year-old now, and, you know, motherhood was a huge transformation and just kind of shattered my belief system about what went on behind closed doors when I wasn't there as a nanny, you know. And I just have so much more respect for her now that I am a mom.
And are you at home, or are you also working
outside?
I'm staying
at home, actually. So I realize the merits of both in a different way than I did when I was, you know, young and doing this and childless. So.
Well, thanks for the call, Mary Beth. It's an interesting experience, isn't it, when you see, Susan, the sort of flip side of that, and particularly when it's with your own child.
Absolutely. You see the 24/7 of it, you know? And for those of us who are mothers, we know the night terrors at 2 a.m. We know the projectile vomiting at 4 a.m. We know the teenager who comes home and won't talk to you for 6 hours, and you're struggling in each of these cases to reach your child and to get something from them. And it's, you know, it's a lot of hard work and a lot of attention. And, you know, I think you know, what Mary Beth was pointing out is that, again, one size doesn't fit all. And the other thing is you need to look at outcomes, right? We are so used to having the surveillance cameras on us as mothers from women's magazines, the news media, advice columns, et cetera, that we don't stand back for a minute, catch our breath, and look at the kids. How are the kids doing? Are the kids fine? You know, if you're feeling, I have to tell you, I stand, and this is totally stereotypical. My kid plays soccer, so yes, I'm on the soccer lines a lot, okay? I'm on the soccer lines with mothers, and I know these mothers. They're great mothers. Doesn't matter whether they work outside the home or not. They're devoted to their kids. And I will tell you that I talk to these mothers, and they feel bad about themselves. They feel that whatever they're doing, it's not enough, you know. And they're great. So, and they don't stop for a minute and look at their kids. How are their kids doing? Their kids are playing sports. Their kids have friends. Their kids are doing fine in school. Their kids are healthy and confident. Great. Let's start looking at outcomes instead of policing ourselves so much, which is what we're urged to do.
I was going to say, is there an argument to be made here that perhaps the 24/7 obsessiveness is actually counterproductive? You know, part of being a kid is they need time to daydream. They need time to figure some things out for themselves, as opposed to having being completely micromanaged by a parent, whether it's a mother or a father.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. We've gotten into this mindset where supposedly we mothers, much more so than fathers, are supposed to not let one sacred minute, right, go untapped in terms of its developmental potential. Now, having said this, we have no idea what the consequences are of drilling a six-month-old with flashcards. I have my own suspicions, and I don't think that that's such a good plan. We have no idea what it means to put a 12-month-old in front of a computer screen. We don't know any of this stuff. And yet young mothers today are bombarded by messages that if you're not doing this, your kid is going to fall behind. So we don't know anything about what that means cognitively. And then to get back to your point, your kid and my kid, when they grow up, are going to have to stand in line at the Division of Motor Vehicles, just like everybody else. They're going to have to share. They're going to have to wait their turn. And they are not going to be the center of the universe. And so, you know, one does get concerned about the message they might get when they're young, that they are entitled, that they should be waited on, that they are the sun king, you know, when in fact, in real life, they aren't going to be that.
Let's go to Newton, Massachusetts. Now we want to hear from Robin. Hi, Robin. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gail. I haven't seen you since preschool drop-off.
Oh, my goodness.
I just want to say I used to teach, and I ran a working mother support group for many, many years. I have a master's degree in education. I think all of what you're saying is absolutely right on. I would only disagree with the fact that I think it's been around for years. I wrote my master's thesis on behaviorism and how everything pointed back to the mothers, you know, and I think that the difference now is that we have a much more educated class of mothers, mothers who are reading, mothers who are worried about their children and what they're reading and their influence on their children. And I think it's always been combated with the competitiveness among mothers. And, you know, there's two things. You know, you never tell anybody how much you make, and you never tell anybody that you yell at your children. And, you know, and I used to give parent conferences, and parents would come to me so distraught, you know, just exactly what you said about the soccer mothers on the sidelines, and, you know, how horrible a parent they were and how they were doing disservice to their children. And, you know, I would counter them with tales. I would just, you know, regale them with tales of my own bad parenting. You know, here's a woman with a master's degree in education and, you know, a bachelor's degree in child development, and I was filled. I could one-up them with any story of bad parenting that they would come to me. And, you know, I had a director once who said to me, you are not allowed to use the conference room as a confessional. but I will tell you that made those parents feel better than anything else I could say to them. You know, they would come to me, I'm terrible. I forgot my daughter's field trip. Hey, guess what? I forgot my daughter. You know,
Not for long, I trust.
Yeah, not for long. But, you know, I mean, the thing is that we do sort of set up this competitive nature. And I would say to these mothers, open up. I have a very strong circle of friends, any one of which I can call up on any given day and say, guess what's not going to get me Mother of the Year this year? Mm. And really just open up. And you know, and the best thing they do for me, you know, I have one girlfriend who I call up every time we get a report card and, you know, beat my chest and say, where did I go wrong? And she'll tell me her story. And I will say to her, you're just saying that to make me feel better.
Hmm.
You know, we share these horrible stories, but really it puts it in perspective and to say, you know, there is no perfection in parenting. It is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And almost all of the research shows that good enough parenting is good enough. And the fact that you care and you love your child is enough. And, you know, yes, we never saw Claire Huxtable yelling. You know, we never saw yelling and screaming and slamming doors in the Beaver House.
Gotcha.
I mean, you know, you have a teenage girl. My guess is doors are slamming all the time.
Robin, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. And, you know, that is so true. One of the antidotes to this has to be women being able to confide in each other that, guess what, none of us is perfect.
Well, listen, this is one of the main reasons we wrote this book, is to alleviate guilt and to end the censorship and to get mothers talking to each other. I'll tell you a story that plays exactly off this comment. Right after the book came out, so I went to a volleyball match that my daughter was in, and some of the mothers were there, and they had just gotten the book and read the book. And so they were waving at me across the bleachers, and I went over there. And they said, oh, God, it was so funny to read this book. Now I'm going to tell you this, because this book has given me permission to tell you this. In the spring, when I began to realize, when I was a young mother, that the windows were open. And so when I yelled at the kids, the neighbors could hear. So I would go around the house and shut the windows before yelling at the kids. You know, and we all had a big laugh over this. But she said, now I'm not going to close them anymore.
Hmm.
You know, and of course we all yell at our kids from time to time, you know, and so and we need to give each other permission to do this. I mean, motherhood has become the ultimate female Olympics. You know, we're all in competition with each other, with the mom down the street, with the mom on the magazine cover. We're always supposed to be, you know, cuddly and nurturing and never angry and all the rest. And I think one thing that has been interesting about talking about this book going around the country is that it's almost impossible to make an equation between these two words, mother, angry. Mothers aren't supposed to be angry, right? And the notion is, of course, that we're not supposed to be angry at our kids, because the fear is once you get angry at your kids, then it leads down some dark path.
Mm.
But if mothers get angry with each other collectively about the workplace and politics, that's a whole other ball of wax.
Hmm. Interesting thought. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment after we take a break. We're talking this hour about the idealization of motherhood in the media. Do you agree with actress Catherine Zeta-Jones that motherhood is sexy? Or do those images of perfect mothers in Vogue and in Style and elsewhere make you feel like you don't measure up? Do they make you angry? And what is motherhood like for you? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about idealized images of motherhood in the media. So what do you think? Should the government do something to help overworked mothers? What should the workplace do? And have we gone back to the 1950s ideal of motherhood? How real was that? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Susan Douglas, professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan and co-author of the new book, The Mommy Myth. And let's go back to our phone lines now to Madison, Wisconsin, and hear from Stephanie. Hi, Stephanie, and welcome.
Hi, thank you so much. This is a really wonderful show. First of all, I really remember the feminist movement from the 70s, and I'm so glad that your author, your guest, reprieved those memories for me, brought them back, because it's easy to forget. And, you know, that whole movement was about bringing us all together and being able to talk and to share. And we've really gotten away from that. And thinking about the, you know, those images in the media. Do you guys remember the was it the Anjali commercial? I'm a woman.
I can recite this precisely. You know, I can bring home the bacon, fry it up in the pan, and never ever let you forget you're a man. That one.
Exactly. Here's my point. Issue that's really close to my heart is the prevention of child abuse. And I really think that this perfectionism, this insane pressure that women are put under, and then think about single moms. My daughter is grown and a single mom with two kids and who would love to stay home with her kids. The pressure is so there, and I'm concerned about child abuse because I'm thinking that, you know, mothers have unrealistic expectations, perhaps, about what they're supposed to be doing, and you put that much pressure in addition to being being isolated and other conditions. I think this whole media image problem is just pernicious and may contribute to child abuse.
Okay, Stephanie, let's put that question to Susan, and thanks for the call.
I don't know really the relationship there. I think her point is very well taken, you know, to speculate about the relationships between these incredibly idealized images that are so perfect that if you deviate, you're a failure, and how that can prompt you to lash out at your child. But I just don't know about any kind of studies that have been done about that. But I think to put her, Stephanie's comments in context, here we have these incredibly idealized images, and she mentioned single mothers. Mothers working or stay at home, single or with partners, we have so little support that it is so easy to get stressed out. And in other civilized countries where they have preschool or nursery school, sometimes from infancy, sometimes from 18 months, and sometimes from 3 years old, they have after-school programs, they have, dare I say it, paid maternity leave, they have universal health care, all of the kinds of things that would make being a parent and a mother so much easier. You know, we don't have these things. And all of those also interact with this image of the ideal mother because we look around. None of these things are in place for us. And so we have to pick up the slack and the buck stops with us, right? We have to be superwomen. Mm. And so the lack of institutional supports for families and for mothers interact with this image and could contribute to child abuse. I mean, I just would like people to think about the following question. The GI Bill was one of the most successful social programs ever launched in this country. It revolutionized the lives of millions of people, and not just men, their families. What if we had a GI Bill for families in the 1980s? Mm-hmm. Where would we be today? Mm-hmm. I think we'd be in a different place.
Interesting thought. I want to try to get in one more phone call. Lisa's on the line now from Medway, Massachusetts. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Where to begin? I'm an English professor. I teach full-time. I'm teaching a course called Writing Women. So we're talking all about moms, reading about moms this week. So we're reading really interesting stories, The Yellow Wallpaper, about a crazy mom, and Angel Over the Right Shoulder, about a frustrated mom. So, I'm thinking about the way I talk to my students about this, who are, you know, young women. Oh, there are two men in the class. They don't say anything. But the young women who are, 20, 22, who are kind of looking to the point in their life, they talk about that, having a family, juggling a job. And the paradigm I use is one that an earlier caller talked about, which is this notion of the good enough mom. I mean, I have had to just more and more, maybe it's because I'm over 40, jettison expectations. And, you know, it's really liberating. My kids, I think a lot of what you said, the litmus test of looking at your children, are, you know, my children seem pretty happy. We talk. We don't do as many family activities as I might like. But my kids talk to me. My kids are pretty, they seem very happy. I'm very fortunate that I have great daycare providers, although I think your point about we don't really support people's daycare. I mean, you get a very minuscule tax credit for your daycare. That, you know, we don't give the economic support for women doing that. And that's a lot of what, when I work a lot right now, I mean, I work because I want to work, and I'm very open about that. I have a doctorate, and I love my job, and I have to work. I would make a really bad stay-at-home mom, and my kids agree with that. But, you know, and for me, it's you know, I laugh at the media images because I, you know, I know that I gave up Martha Stewart Living. She was too anxiety-provoking.
All right, Lisa, we thank you for the call. We're running out of time, but thank you so much for being with us. And what about that? Are there role models that are better than the ones we've been given of the perfect celebrity mom with the perfect children and the white sofa?
Well, I want to make one quick response to Lisa, which is that one of the things that the Mommy Myth cites is this book by Peggy Orenstein called Flux, which looked at the lives of 200 women starting from their late teens up until their 70s. And what she found is that the very girls that Lisa is teaching idealized motherhood much more than marriage, you know? So it's really out there. And I think the important thing for us to do as teachers is get them to look at these images of Sarah Jessica Parker and Reese Witherspoon and deconstruct them and put them in relationship to other kinds of things that she's having them, you know, read. But,
And maybe look at people like Meryl Streep, who was a little more forthcoming about how hard it is.
You know, I have two responses about role models. And Meryl Streep I have admired enormously because Meryl Streep, any time she's been interviewed that I've seen her in magazines, Meryl Streep has said, you know, the interviewer said, oh, how do you do it all? You're so wonderful. And Meryl Streep has said, do not idealize me. Don't put me on a pedestal. I have tons of help. I couldn't do it without the help. But I have to tell you, you know the role models I admire? They're women in my everyday life. They're my colleagues, my friends, my relatives. Those are my role models, and I think those should be all of our role models, and we should stop putting these phony, you know, celebrity images, which even are for fake for them, up on some kind of pedestal.
Susan Douglas, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Susan Douglas is co-author of The Mommy Myth, and you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In just a moment, the story of the most important baseball league most Americans have never even heard of. This is On Point. While much of the nation slept, Major League Baseball kicked off its 2004 season in Tokyo, Japan on Tuesday with the New York Yankees and Tampa Bay Devil Rays splitting two games. The season's first game on U.S. soil will be played on April 4th. A remarkable one out of every six players on baseball's opening day rosters got to the big leagues via the relatively obscure Cape Cod League. Players like Nomar Garciaparra and Mo Vaughn and Robin Ventura. For 11 weeks each summer, 10 small towns across the Cape field teams featuring the nation's top college players. In a few years, many of them will be multimillionaires. But for that summer, they are 20-year-old dreamers. They play on high school fields. They live with local volunteer families and are required to work summer jobs during the day. Buck Showalter flipped eggs in Hyannis. Frank Thomas mowed lawns in Brewster. Baseball writer Jim Collins spent the summer of 2002 observing the Cape Cod League's Chatham A's, and he writes about that season in his new book, The Last Best League. In this radio diary, he tells the story of the most important baseball league most Americans have never heard of.
The Cape League has been sending guys on to the pros ever since the 1920s. Future Hall of Famers Mickey Cochran and Pye Trainer played there back in the 1920s. Thurman Munson, Carlton Fisk played there. Jeff Reardon from the 60s played there. And then today you look at Major League rosters and you see all-stars almost on every team who played and came up through the Cape. Mo Vaughn played there. Frank Thomas, a couple of big names in baseball. Barry Zito, who won the Cy Young Award 2 years ago, was a pitcher down there. It's sprinkled with Major League all-stars and even some Hall of Famers. Carlton Fisk played for Orleans one summer down there. One of the wonderful juxtapositions of the Cape Cod League is that the fields are high school baseball fields. They're not fancy. They don't have big, elaborate infrastructure around them like stands and any kind of a stadium feel. And that some of the teams don't even use locker rooms. They change uniforms right in the parking lot before the game starts. And they might get 1,000 or 2,000 fans out for a game in the evening, but half the fans are on picnic blankets or lawn chairs. So there's a sense of a real small town team atmosphere, even as 40 of the people that night watching may be Major League scouts with radar guns and clipboards, and they're sorting out the players and adjusting their prospect charts and really deciding who is going to go high in the Major League draft the following year and who may not be good enough to make it. There's a phrase that even college players start using. It's called big leaguing. And it's become a verb that happens when celebrity happens to these athletes. As they become professionals, they start big leaguing people. They don't give them the time or the honesty or the openness that you might want from someone that you'd like to get to know. And these guys are all celebrities in the making, but they aren't quite there yet. So they're very open and candid and easy to be around, just hanging out. And one of the things that really intrigued me about doing a book on the Cape League was what that view looked like of celebrity before the celebrity hit. Can you imagine being 20 years old and being a stud athlete and being down on the Cape during the summertime? And one of the players described it like having that new car smell around you all the time. It just had a shine on it. And the image that I came back to, it's not anything that I made up in my head, but these guys drive with the windows down and the radio cranked, and life is a beach. And it really is that way for the summer, except if you're struggling, or except if you're maybe failing at something that you've never failed at before. Or except if 50 Major League scouts have just watched you strike out for the third time in a game and you start wondering what's going on and are you really going to make it after all? And you might have been dreaming about something since you were 4 years old and you're suddenly coming face to face with something. And yet later that night you go out onto the beach down below the Chatham Lighthouse and there's a bonfire and the wind is coming in off the water and that milky beam of light is swinging around from the Cape Light. And, you know, guys are drinking beer and there are girls around maybe doing some skinny dipping. And it's just that juxtaposition. Position of career hopes and dreams, but also being 20 years old on Cape Cod in the summer. And I love the richness of those things, you know, set next to each other. At the beginning of the book, I talk about some of the backgrounds of where these players came from, some of the just incredible dedication they'd already shown as high school players and even younger. And now all of their names had come together on the roster of the Chatham A's. Schiffner's recruits for the 2002 Chatham A's understood much about what a summer in the Cape Cod Baseball League meant, even if only intuitively. The players knew that for those not big or fast or talented enough to go on, the summer on the Cape would stand as the height of their achievement, the nearest to professional they would experience. There was no place left after this except the solace of fantasy camps, beer leagues, and fast-pitch softball. And for those who did move up the professional ranks, the game would soon become a business, lose its innocence, some of its fun. Except for the rarest of players who went on to star in the minors or the major leagues, Cape Cod would be the last place these athletes would ever stand above the heads and shoulders of their peers. What they didn't know, couldn't possibly know, was who among them would make the cut. The Chatham coach, John Schiffner, knew at least one more thing that would come clear later. They would never again have a season like the one that experienced with him. They would never again be 20 years old, playing baseball on Cape Cod with their entire lives and all the sky in front of them. Many of the players, both the ones who stopped here and the ones who climbed further, would look back at this as the last best summer of their playing careers.
Jim Collins is the author of the new book, The Last Best League, One Summer, One Season, One Dream. He's the former editor of Yankee Magazine and a contributing editor to U.S. Airways Attaché Magazine. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Jane Manners and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.